From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made in your workplace. How's the culture where you work? Do you feel open to ask questions or offer constructive, if challenging, feedback? Do you feel unheard or mistreated or not valued very much? Do you think you are compensated fairly? Have your leaders earned your trust or the trust of your coworkers? I'm curious about that. A new book explores all of this and a lot more, and it comes from someone that I have known and respected for years now. Kit Miller is the director emeritus of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester. She was the executive director for 12 years. So why is someone who is so focused on nonviolence principles spending so much time looking at the American workplace? Well, Miller's book explains that the principles of nonviolence extend to our offices, our organizations, our jobs. It relates to what people get paid, who gets to take time off, who gets to offer ideas and who doesn't, which organizations have strong and loving leaders. Miller has plenty of experience here. Much of her current work involves being an educator who guides teams on dealing with conflict. And we can't build a world entirely free of conflict. I mean, maybe we can. I'm going to ask Kit, am I being too cynical? Is there a future full of free of conflict? Maybe. But for now, what we can do is talk about handling conflict much more effectively and creating much more harmonious environments where we work. The book is called Culture Shift, Nonviolence at Work. Kit Miller, the author, former executive director of the Gandhi Institute. It is so lovely to see you in studio.
Thank you.
Like one of the top people who just make me feel a little more secure and better about the world every time I talk to you. So no pressure. It's going to be a big 50 minutes. Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you.
And let me also say hello to Aaron Thompson, who's the executive director of the Gandhi Institute. Not a co-author, but someone who I think has co-authored the culture over at Gandhi very well. Thank you for being back with us here.
It's a pleasure to be here, Evan.
What do you make of this book? What do you think of Kit's work here?
I am so grateful and happy that Kit took the time to take the field notes, cobble them together into this narrative, this history of the Institute. This is a true a workbook, and I'm excited to see what the public does with this, because it's chock full of incredible and practical ideas.
I'm going to mention something that I said to the guests right before the program began, and it's just going to sound overly teed up and gushing, but I'm just going to say this. A lot of people know that there's a new CEO at WXXI. We're all getting to know Chris Moore. But first time I heard him in person, I said to colleagues, you know, without knowing him very, very well, it seems very clear that he is set on establishing a very healthy culture. And without a healthy culture, you can have the best innovator in the world. You can have someone who has all of these ideas that can really be disruptive and interesting. But if the culture is terrible, I don't know what you think you can achieve. So it feels really good to work at a place that feels like the culture is very good. And Kit, I want to ask why you felt like this book is so needed right now.
So many reasons. I actually started a new job recently, so I'm now working over at U of R in the Office of Equity and Inclusion. I'm part of the restorative practices team there. And I have been doing that work as a consultant for a while. I've also been working as a consultant at UNICEF for a couple of years in the interim since I walked away from Gandhi Institute and was working on the book. And so I've had opportunity to see a lot of different teams in a lot of different spaces working on issues that are local, national, international. And I wanted to help more people bring their values into the workplace so that we don't have two sets of norms, two sets of values. You know, what do we do in some spaces, like maybe with our family and friends, and then what we turn around and do at work. I wanted to help and inspire groups to thrive. You know, even right now, if every single person in the United States had the exact president that they wanted to have, we would still be up against some significant issues. We have an enormous national debt. We have issues of climate change that are intruding everywhere. We have so many things going on. I want us to be, at this point, people who are able to bring everything we have, all our creativity, all our values, into the spaces that we inhabit. And that could be spaces in our faith communities. It could be the community work that we do, that many people I know in Rochester pour their hearts into their community work unpaid. Like, we need to bring our best selves into all these spaces. So I was hoping the book would help with that.
Well, and certainly it is logical for listeners to wonder, you know, okay, nonviolence principles and protest movements and all kinds of different settings in schools, but like, in the American workplace, how do the principles apply? So that's what we're going to be talking about. But do you think people are surprised to contextualize it in this way, to think about their workplaces as needing nonviolence principles?
I think people are less surprised than they used to be.
Mm.
But I do think for some people that might be kind of like a little bit of a head scratcher, but that's cool. you know, I mean, I do feel that most people, the polarization that's affecting us nationally is not absent from people's workplaces or their faith communities or their families. So how do we navigate conflicts in a good way? How do we have actually fun fights? I mean, Evan, if you and I worked together, we would have arguments all the time.
We would not.
Yes, we would.
No.
Well, there would be a lot of trust between us, so you wouldn't even think it or call it an argument. Like, disagreements with people where there's high trust, we can argue with each other all the time, but we don't think it's a conflict. It becomes a conflict when people don't trust one another and they don't feel that they matter.
So there's a word that I want to start with here that I think is at the root of what you just described, and it's contempt. And you write about it. I want to read a little bit, a short passage from your book. The reason I want to start here is I think people who are listening can probably relate to the idea of, is there someone you work with now or have worked with who you struggle to respect, or you feel some really intense negative feelings about, that you feel like you can't have kind of an intellectually honest conversation because you don't respect them, or that terribly negative feeling? Or do you feel like there's someone who looks at you that way? The notion of contempt makes it, I think, and Kit will talk about this, probably impossible to have the kind of healthy arguments, discussions, debates, idea sessions that Kit is talking about. So Kit writes about contempt. Quote, as we explore the gap between stimulus and response, we might feel contempt bubbling up, especially for our past gaps in understanding. Contempt is the feeling that a person or a thing is beneath consideration, is worthless, or deserving scorn. In many contexts, it is a gateway to lasting harm. Contempt sets the table for dehumanizing self and others, for creating, among other things, what Marshall Rosenberg called enemy images. We may experience enemy images as static judgments of ourselves and others that block us from a more complete and more compassionate understanding. Examples of enemy images at work might include fixed narratives about who's a good worker, who is responsible, who deserves support, and who does not, end quote. I think that is so relatable, and yet so difficult to uproot and remove. So I want to start with a question. If people feel deep contempt for others, can that be eliminated? Can you sort of train yourself to remove contempt?
I think that the cultures where we operate are either supporting the presence of contempt or supporting efforts to dismantle contempt. So that's why the title of the book is called Culture Shift. When there is an active culture and effort to indicate that all people matter, that actually our diverse views are necessary for the best work to take place regardless of the field that we're in, it's harder for any one individual, I think, to sustain an attitude of contempt when they're surrounded by people who do not stand by the idea of contempt. I think if we're in a space where it's permissible for any one person to be treated with contempt, and it's tolerated by the leadership, or it's tolerated by the informal leaders that exist in every single work group, then it's easier to let it thrive. But I don't believe that any one person will be able to continue contempt in a group if no one else plays in, no one else buys in. And if the people that work with a person, when they see them indicating contempt, and, you know, again, because of the work that I do, I see spaces where people are held in contempt. Maybe their religion isn't the religion of everybody else is in the space, or their background, their ethnicity, you know, whatever. But if no one in the group is willing to tolerate contempt, it's very hard for any one person to thrive in a space and hold someone else in contempt. So that's why I think culture, it creates norms. And the stronger our norms are in terms of being inclusive and making sure that we know that the best work is done by the most diverse groups of human beings, there's all sorts of data on that, then I think it's harder to sustain contempt. And we can challenge people that we care about, whether at work or elsewhere, who we see kind of caught in contempt, to rethink it.
There's two prongs I want to ask you about this, and I want to ask Aaron about this as well. First of all, just on the subject of coworkers and how you evaluate them as coworkers, not based on any, you know, immutable characteristics, but Kit, if I'm in a one-on-one session with you and we're talking about contempt and I say, yeah, but my coworker is just the worst. They don't pull their weight. They're not honest about how much work they're doing. They don't listen well. Their ideas are bad. You know, I can't respect them. I can't go into a conversation thinking that, like, we're on equal footing. I don't think that they deserve it. What do you say to that?
Well, first thing I would acknowledge is it must be really challenging for you to work with someone where there's that level of struggle. You know, and I can see that it would make complete sense that you want to have colleagues that you can trust and lean on and whose ideas you value, even if you don't agree with them. I think it's really important for us to recognize the difference between understanding and agreement. We often, when we don't want to acknowledge that we agree with someone, we also withhold understanding. So pulling apart understanding from agreement is a really important key. So if I was talking to someone like that, I would just say, yeah, of course you want to have colleagues like that. I get it. I 100% get it. And then I would start to ask some other questions like, have you ever had a chance to kind of talk to this colleague or give them any feedback about what it's like for you to be working with them? And then mostly people would probably say no, because we're afraid. We're afraid to have difficult conversations. We don't have support to have difficult conversations. So then I would say, do you have support of any kind through your manager or supervisor to be able to have a difficult conversation with a colleague? And often again, the answer would be not really or no. And so then we move into, you know, so, okay, so what are the skills and what are the structures that are needed for the relationships within this team to be held and nurtured in a good way? So all three things are needed for good work: relationships, skills, and structures. It's one of the points I make in the book. And in a lot of workspaces, you know, we spend money on training. So we think if we just skill people up, we'll be okay. But relationships aren't tended to, and structures for when all that breaks down are not created, that are created and co-created by the people that need them. So that's some ideas.
Yeah, there's all these tangents that keep coming up as I talk to Kit. So this is not, I'm not going to be at my best in this interview because I keep thinking of things I want to ask about. And so I apologize in advance. Aaron, I apologize. I'm going to do my best this hour here. But let me just hit these tangents here before we talk about how Aaron views the importance of culture and open dialogue and avoiding contempt in places like Gandhi. But you talked about the difference between understanding and agreement. Mm-hmm. And recently on this program, I had a guest who, it was a very civil conversation. It was a gentleman who had run for New York State Senate. I respect him very much and said so. And he was very beholden to the idea that, for example, the 2020 election was stolen. It was stolen from Donald Trump. And I said, you know, listen, I have to set a firm boundary of where I think facts are. I want to honor disagreement. That's one of the places where I want to set a boundary on facts as we understand them. And he said, well, you got to read my sources. And I said, everything that you just mentioned, I've read. He said, no, you haven't. If you had read it, you would agree with me. Hmm. I said, no, I promise you. I've read those. I've read the court cases. I've read the articles. Just because we don't agree doesn't mean I don't understand your point. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I obviously, so, he's a very nice gentleman. And I do hope, and I'm not bringing this up out of school, it was a conversation we had here, but I was jarred by this idea that the only thing that was worth achieving was agreement, as opposed to, hey, we both consumed information and we're not going to be in the same place, but that's okay. We understand one another. And I didn't know how to navigate that, and I probably didn't do very well. But that's an important concept, because I think couples struggle with this, spouses struggle with this, kids struggle. This idea that if you just consumed what I consumed, you would agree with me entirely. And if you don't, then if you don't agree with me, then clearly you're lacking some information, as opposed to, do you understand it differently, and can I honor that and respect it? I don't think we do very well with that. I think I don't do very well with that.
I think agreement is like a marker for a lot of people about respect. So if you don't agree with me, then you don't respect me.
Then you don't respect me, yes.
So what I would want to do is convey in my tone and in my language that I actually have a lot of respect for you. And I'm excited about the fact that you and I read the same thing and came up with different conclusions. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, well, that's a great way to put it, right?
And have you ever had anything like that happen before? I have. I have also had that happen before. So, like, just to dig into it a little bit is a dynamic. And just keep recognizing that most of us, you know, we really are hungry for understanding. We're hungry for respect. And if we stay with people in those moments, in my experience, you know, we get somewhere, we get it to a different place.
I like this idea of signaling to a coworker, signaling to someone, I can respect you even if we disagree. Like, I promise you, you're not being disrespected. We just don't happen to have the same opinion about something or the idea about something. I think that's really powerful. The other prong that I wanted to just ask you about on contempt is, in my experience, sometimes people who have the most passionate ideas about justice, for example, of which both of you work quite often with people, you yourselves have passionate views on what justice looks like and what it should, how it should function. Often, that feeling of the importance of a pursuit of justice can lead someone to start feeling contempt for others who don't feel that same level of passion, or disagree about how to get there, or disagree about a particular issue or even a set of facts. How do you navigate and pull back from contempt when you feel like I'm working towards justice here? And why isn't this person engaged the same way? Why does this person not listen? Why do they not care the way I do? How do you avoid contempt in that situation?
I would personally, I would look for where is the common ground? What do they care about? What's really important to them? One of the things that I really appreciate it having learned years ago is sort of separating strategies to meet our needs from the needs themselves. So, yep, we might, you know, like, actually this happened many times when Aaron and I worked together. We had different ideas for how to get things done, but the underlying needs that we were trying to meet to move forward were shared. And so out of that sort of shared basis and the trust that comes out of that, we could have really good, you know, disagreements about, well, you know, I think we should do this. And no, I think this is probably the way we ought to go. And we would go back and forth. And I advocate for this in the book. I don't think it's wise for us to surround ourselves with people who see things the same way that we do. I think that we want to build a shared base of values together, but not that we are like an echo chamber for one another.
I think that's so important. There are echo chambers everywhere. I'm so guilty of it myself. And to be pushed ideologically, to be pushed on ideas, can feel really uncomfortable. Aaron, how do you create spaces where people can feel comfortable even pushing you? You know, you're the boss.
I don't use that term to refer to myself.
I literally use that term thinking there's no way Aaron loves that phrase, which makes you, by the way, that's what makes you a great boss.
So we've been talking about contempt. I think that one of the casualties of contempt, when it is allowed to exist, is curiosity. And so, you know, the skill element of that triangle of skill, structure, and relationship, I think the skill part of that involves being able to, when a person finds themselves challenged by a colleague or, you know, feeling contempt rising up in them, because I don't know that we'll stamp it out as a feeling that we experience as humans. I think culturally, we, like Kit has been mentioning, we can transform our spaces so that it shows up less and less. I don't know that we're completely eliminate, right? But if we train ourselves to sit with that initial wave of heat, of contempt, of pushback, and then recognize that there's a reason that this person is showing up like they are or has this view that is, you know, completely divergent from mine, or is otherwise a challenge to me, it is triggering the sense of challenge or frustration in me. There's a reason for that. And if we can get curious about that and like move toward trying to overcome, to get clear on why that's the case, that's a way of kind of transforming the dynamic you know, moving kind of constructively forward, especially, particularly if there is some basis of trust in the relationship. Yeah.
I want to jump ahead a little bit because we're going to hit different themes in the book. The book is called Culture Shift, Nonviolence at Work. The author, Kit Miller, is with us. Aaron Thompson, who is, he's not the boss, he's the executive director of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester. But leadership matters. And there's a really, I think, important section on choosing leaders, setting a culture, earning trust, understanding rank. And I want to talk about that with you because, I don't manage anybody here. It's just me. And I'm comfortable with that. And that's been the way it's been for me for a long time at work. To the extent that I'm ever a boss, it's when I'm coaching a team of kids, you know. I don't like the term boss either. But I mean, a leader in a role where people are, you have some authority. Mm. And I'm always, even in that context, thinking like, do they trust me? Is this a valuable, are they getting something valuable out of this? Am I worth this? Like, you know, I mean, it's amazing even in that context how I can doubt myself being a valid choice for people to invest trust and energy with. And so I want to ask you about first what it is like being chosen to lead and how you earn trust, because there's a really important section on the earning of trust in this book.
Yeah, it is. It feels weighty. So it is a role that I take seriously, and I recognize that, you know, for the duration of time I'm going to be in a leadership position, I'm going to be learning that entire time. Hopefully along with everyone else on my staff. And, you know, I think that to the extent that I've earned the trust of my colleagues at the Institute and other folks who I engage with professionally, I think it has to do with how I show up. You know, I really work to avoid putting on my director hat unless it is explicitly called for, and instead really just talking about whatever the facts of the matter are with my colleagues and staff, you know, recognizing that I'm a part of the team, and so I provide some direction and also am responsive to my colleagues' input.
I want everybody to read this section. I want everybody to read this book, but this section of the book I think is so important. And there's a section on earning trust and being worthy of it. Some of what you just talked about, at least in my bias, is exactly how you do that. You make it clear that you don't, in your own eyes, view yourself as more important than others just because the rank is different. But there is also a section on understanding rank. And, you know, Aaron, there is this tension between the idea of wanting a more egalitarian society, a more egalitarian workplace, and wanting to set a culture that says, I may be the person at the top of the leadership chain, but everybody here is valued, will be listened to, will be heard. And yet realizing that at moments that rank will matter, that your choices and direction will have to be where the decision gets made. How do you navigate understanding rank in that way without trying to sort of flex that rank and abuse it?
Right.
Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. So, I mean, the role that I hold is executive director. That has a meaning. There's a function there. I think that there are times when executive decisions are called for, and it's up to the person in that role to make the call. I think everything up to that point really, really matters, and the process by which that decision to be made was reached, and the input and the involvement and the understanding of like the path to this point where this decision has to be made by me or whomever's in that role, to be clearly understood and bought into, by the team. We have a pretty flat structure, and we've had, basically there is the executive director and there are staff. We're making some modifications in real time now to that, but I mean, generally, it's just a very flat structure at the Gandhi Institute, and so that requires pretty regular communication between everyone involved. It helps that we're a small shop as well, so constant and clear communication is important.
Well, let me turn to the author. So I really loved listening to Aaron talk about that. I mean, the culture that he wants to help set it, I think, is so strong that I take the point that sometimes an executive director will have to make that final call, but you're not making it unilaterally and you're not making it in an exclusionary way, and everyone knows it. And that is huge for any organization, because many of us at some point in our lives have experienced what it's like to have someone who is domineering, someone who flexes rank. And, Kit even talks about a letter that you sent, which is a story that I think was really interesting. Back when you were attending a program for senior leaders in the World Bank, can you tell that story? And can we talk a little bit about rank and how you see the importance of these distinctions?
Sure. Yeah. So many stories I share in the book were actually of times when I messed up or times when I saw other people mess up, because there's so much learning to be had. And I actually really like it now, remembering that when something's going kind of sideways, that, this is going to be extra interesting for potential learning capture. Yeah. When things go really well, sometimes it's kind of like, okay, that went well, and then you move on. But when things don't go the way you wanted, it gets extra interesting. So I appreciate that that's, for the most part, my default setting now. I was invited a long time ago to be a sort of an interesting, spicy person at a World Bank leadership seminar that was taking place in this incredibly schwank place in Virginia, the kind of place that I've visited once in my life. and I was sitting, with heads of the World Bank, at night over a glass of wine or something, and hearing from them. And at the time, this was the head of the World Bank in the Philippines, head of the World Bank in what was called Russia, all these people that would be seen by the outside world as being highly influential humans, big budgets, big staffs. And I've had other opportunities kind of more recently, actually, in with working with UNICEF for similar kinds of dialogue and conversation. And what I really began to recognize from that time was that here are these people that most people in the world would see as super influential. They genuinely, one-on-one, did not see themselves that way. Genuinely. And I've had these conversations with other leaders too, where people are genuinely don't see themselves as influential. And then I began to wonder, who the heck sees themselves as genuinely influential? I mean, really, because there's this, kind of a dividing line between, I'm just being humble, but also I have to acknowledge that I carry that I have the rank that I have. I have the status that I have. And sometimes for some of us, it's status that's given to us by virtue of a role, you know, like Aaron was just naming, you know, when I serve in this role, these are the responsibilities and the obligations and the opportunities that I get as a result of it. And then, of course, as you read in the book, there's other kinds of rank and status that's kind of gifted to us by virtue of our birth. It might be, you know, that the way our brains work, you know, that our brains work well for the existing school system. Not everybody has a brain that works well for the way that we educate young people. You know, that we have a body that works in a way that we would call typical, that we, you know, we have. And then there's the culturally shaped ones around, you know, are we heterosexual, our race, you know, our immigration status, right? All these things are forms of rank. And so in the book, I list out my forms of rank, and I ask other people to really think about it, too, because when we tend to sidestep the power that we have, we often leave a lot of possibilities out, and we tend to overlook what other people's value. So to be really serious about what are the rank and privileges that I walk with in the world and how can I use them in a good way? And I tried to share, you know, some of those stories also in the book about times when I decided to walk towards somebody either in the community or in other places, deliberately trying to use all those gifts that I have. What Gandhi called all these kinds of gifts, like that we're trustees of our gifts. So like, you know, a gift that you have, Evan, is you sit there and you get to decide like who gets their voice out in the air. That's an incredible gift that you and Megan have, right? And so like to be real serious about the value of the gifts that we get and the gifts that we have. The letter story from the World Bank was that, so, you know, I went to this thing. It was really interesting. They flew everybody back to D.C. a few months later to kind of wrap up the program. And I was sitting at a table, and one of the men in the table and who had been in my group, we were chatting at dinner. And when the head of the World Bank at the time, who shall remain nameless, came in, and he was there to sort of say, good job, everybody, for participating in this important program. And then he did like 5 minutes of Q&A. And when the guy at my table asked a question, the head of the World Bank answered him in such a cutting and contemptuous way. As I say in the book, it felt like a chill fell over the whole room. And I thought, whoa, they probably spent millions of dollars to try to develop the sense of like autonomy and leadership of all these people in this room. And that one response this man made, because for whatever reason, he didn't like the topic, he didn't like the person, it just hit him the wrong way. It felt like it diminished the entire value of the program that they obviously put a great deal of resources in. And so I wrote the guy a letter. I wrote the head of the World Bank a letter because I was one of the very few people in the room that didn't report to the bank. And I was like, you know, if he doesn't like what I say, he can't really do anything to me. So that was an opportunity, again, for me to use my rank in the moment because I saw myself as having more independence than almost anybody else in the room.
And he wrote you back and he said, I've really taken this to heart. Thank you very... Oh, no, he didn't do that.
No, I got a...
You got a form letter.
I got a form letter back. And yet I, you know, it's like one of those things. You do the right thing and without attachment to what comes back to you.
You do the right thing and let the consequences follow.
Yeah.
Briefly, and I'm late for a break. I just got to close the point on leadership here. There's a section where you're talking to a friend of yours named Freda Jacques, mm-hmm. who is an Onondaga Nation clan mother. And I just want to read some of what she said. And then I just want to ask you one other question about leadership. She said, quote, I'll never understand how you people choose your leaders. And she went on to say that I look for leaders starting in childhood. I don't choose leaders who like to stand in front of the room and talk. I look for those who shovel driveways in the winter or fill the wood box without being asked, end quote. And she was telling you this because she doesn't see those qualities in a lot of the people who are getting elected or being chosen for leadership in many ways. And so
I think she was critiquing the system of how we choose leaders
rather
than the leaders themselves. She was doing both. She's a smart human.
Well, the corner of the room, there was a big image of Donald Trump on the screen. But regardless, not about an individual here, critiquing a system mm-hmm. and critiquing a value set that goes into what would make a good leader. What are we looking for? I just want to ask you, When a company, if a group comes to you, if an organization says, Kit, we got to choose the next leader. Don't have a lot of time to think about it. Give us a quick mindset that's going to improve our culture in choosing a leader, what should we be doing?
I would say to look for people who recognize the importance of relationships and human beings as central. That if we treat people like objects, that there's no way we can do our best work. That's one thing I would say, time pressed, like right now.
I think that's pretty profound. That's why I asked. Kit Miller is the author of Culture Shift, Nonviolence at Work. And Kit and Aaron Thompson, who's also with us, have both been in the role of leadership at the M.K. Gandhi Institute in Rochester, and really appreciate them being here. We have to take this only short break of the hour, and we're going to come right back and talk about some of the other tenets that are subjects of this really profound book. I'm Evan Dawson, Wednesday on The Next Connections. In our first hour, we're joined by Valerie Perry from the Democratization Policy Council in Europe. She'll talk about what she is hearing from European leaders about how they view the change in foreign policy from the United States to come. In our second hour, Senator Jeremy Cooney is fresh off winning re-election and fresh off a trip to other states where he's looking at high-speed rail and transportation options, and we'll talk about it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Kit Miller applying the principles of nonviolence to nonviolence at work, and we're not talking about, generally speaking, you know, physical safety at work, although, of course, that can come up. But we're talking about really every aspect of our workplace. Is it a healthy place to be? Is it a place where the culture is strong and good and loving? Is the leadership effective? And there's a lot here that I'm not even going to have time to talk about, but I'm going to try to work through as effectively as I can some of the things that pop to me. I want to ask you about the idea of should versus voluntary efforts. I want to ask both of you about this. And I'll try to sum up briefly, and then I'm going to give you the floor, Kit, to kind of explain more or correct the host here, as the case may be. But the idea of should is this idea that, well, you have a job and you should be doing this. I don't know if you really want to or if you don't really feel like it's something that is inspiring to you, but you should, you do it, versus voluntary efforts, people inspired to pick up a task, to get it done, to do it at a high level, to feel good about it, or I should get it done by X time. I don't know if I have time. I'll get it done, you know, versus I am proud to be doing it. I'm ready to be doing it. I'm voluntarily doing it. I'm probably I'm not describing it perfectly, and you're going to do better. So why don't you talk a little bit about the idea of should, and then I've got a couple questions about it.
All the ideas in this book are from experiments on myself. I'm an autonomy nut. When I'm bossing myself around, like I can't even stand an alarm clock, Evan. Like, I don't have an alarm clock because I would just be in a fight with myself the minute I open my eyes in the morning. I'm not getting up now, damn it. You know, like I started working with all this should stuff because of my own personality, not wanting to boss myself around even. So wanting to translate shoulds is part something that I learned a long time ago. So instead of saying, you know, you should give more time to Aaron to talk right now, I would even translate inside of my head. I actually want to Aaron's voice to be out in this interview as much as it has been. If I am talking to a group of people and saying, you know, this needs to be done, is there anyone that has capacity to do it? Is there anyone who's excited about doing it? Who wants to work together on it? So, and just to really to make an invitation for more work rather than tell people they have to. And it's one of the things that I love about doing the restorative practices work that I do now at UR and URMC is that the work that we do is bringing teams together to look at issues that are happening, and they're always informal and they're voluntary processes. So if people feel like they have to be in the room, I usually look at them and say, "You please feel free to get up and go. You don't have to stay here." So when people have a sense of choice, I find that most of them are pretty willing to go forward. If their habitual energy is to be without choice, then resentment follows, poor performance follows. So what I want to do is trust people more to have that choice in every setting that they possibly can. And as I say in the book, you know, for the most part, even managing, and it wasn't just at Gandhi Institute, it was in my previous opportunity to work too in this field in Oakland, California. Getting rid of shoulds in the workplace actually led to really good outcomes. And yep, some things didn't get done. And as I say in the book, there's drop deadlines and missed project opportunities in places where there's tons of should thinking with less joy, less laughter, less wholeheartedness. So I know it's a controversial idea because the should idea is so deeply indoctrinated, but it starts with actually with our own work on should. It's not, and then looking out at other people.
So two brief follow-ups, and then I want to turn it over to Aaron because I want to understand how Aaron sees the question of should. When you talk about a meeting where you tell people, hey, if you got to get up and be somewhere, like, you don't have to be here. I think the vast majority of American workplaces, if that were communicated from a leader, the employees would view it as a trap. As a, yeah, if I get up and leave and walk out, I know exactly what they're going to think of me. As opposed to, like, they're busy, they feel like they can be more productive elsewhere. So it takes an extraordinary culture in which that message is received as, that is a legitimate invitation, and I will not be viewed differently.
Right, and that's where the continuous attention to trust.
Yeah, that doesn't happen on probably day one.
Right, that's why what you're naming now is part of a larger section of the book where we're talking about building that.
Absolutely.
Yep.
The other question I had for you on should is, maybe it is because it's deeply ingrained in me. Maybe you're right about that. I read this going like, I'm like 80% on board. And then like there's 20% of me that's like, no. Like
Full of it.
Sorry, but like there has to be, like, sorry, there's a lot of jobs where there's going to be components that are not going to make you feel totally inspired, but you should do it and you have to do it and you better do it. And if you don't do it, then maybe you won't be there very long. And that's just the way of it. Like, I mean, like, there's that part of me that thinks, I don't know, there's certain things that we got to record every day on deadline. And most days I'm pretty excited, but some days I'm like, woo, you know, and I bet I should do it because I don't want dead air from noon to two. So how do I grapple with this? And is it just ingrained in me? The should culture is just so ingrained in me, Kit?
Well, one of the things that I say in the book is that most of, you know, we all have had the same conditioning around these ideas. So you're not the only person who thinks that way. I also think that way. I just got rid of it because I couldn't stand it. I'm an autonomy nut. And I wanted to build sufficient trust within myself that I knew I would do what I wanted to do, even without that should hanging over my head. Like, one of the things I say in the book is that for years at the Institute, we didn't have anyone to come in and do cleaning of the house. And we wanted the house to be beautiful because we shared it with community groups on a continuous basis. So it wasn't just for us. It was for all the groups that used it. I cleaned the bathrooms. I did it partly because I wanted to model something in particular about leadership. And I also really found myself enjoying cleaning the bathrooms because I just love the idea of people coming in and having this really beautiful space to be in. So what I want to invite people into thinking is, if you should yourself for doing something on a routine basis, I invite you to take a look at what are the needs that you're actually meeting by choosing to do it if you could drop the should. So you're doing it, you know, you're like, I don't want to do that recording thing that you talked about. But you're actually choosing to do it because you really want to set yourself up for a good day the next day. So if you drop the should, you can look for actually what are the underlying needs that getting me to want to do this thing, and that I'm not having to use that should language on myself. And if you don't agree with this, those who are listening, feel free to ignore this part of the book.
No. I want to say, I actually think that you just changed my mindset with that last portion there. Mm. Because, yes, there's some things that might feel like an obligation, but like, what's the larger motivation of what we're doing and why?
Right.
And then how do you not just govern yourself by feeling like it's this draconian should?
Right.
It's subtle but important. So how do you model that, or how do you experience that at the Gandhi Institute?
I mean, I'll admit that I'm still challenged by should thinking in my own life, and I try not to project that too explicitly in my work with others, including at the Institute. Work in progress there. But I think, you know, one of the benefits of having a workplace that is that has trust between colleagues shared understanding around what the overarching goals of the organization are, agreement about the sum total of things that need to be done, is that then there can be a little bit more flexibility because people are picking up on each other's slack. So if you have a situation where Kit mentioned, like, you know, she would come to the staff meeting and phrase a request in the manner of, you know, who's up for this or interested in collaborating on this. It doesn't have to be the same person each time, whereas to where one person should or needs to be doing this. You know, they're able to fall back in the moment, opt out of that. There's a likelihood that someone else is going to be ready to kind of stand in their stead. Worst case, you know, if whatever the thing in question doesn't get done immediately, there's trust that the individual who is typically who holds that task is going to get to it in a reasonable enough manner. And, you know, with over time and with evidence of that being the case, it's easier to operate in that manner as a group. And so it comes down to, you know, trust, shared understanding, mutual respect for one another.
I just want to say there's a whole cluster of ideas in the book that relate to this, around also around feedback, around culture of appreciation. So these things are kind of like, if you think of it like a, you know, a garden bed, there's a whole bunch of plants that are tangled together in this particular section of the book. And should is one of the plants in that particular bed.
I think almost more than anything, this book is a manuscript for leaders, because so much of the culture change is going to be very hard to achieve if leadership is opposed to it. So when you talk about feedback, a culture of constructive, healthy, open feedback, a culture of appreciation, so much of that gets set at the quote-unquote top. And I'm going to run out of time, so I've got to ask you about, oh, man, I'm looking at my notes. There's too much, Kit. You're going to have to stay. You know, it's going to have to stay. How can you talk briefly about how nonviolence factors into issues that might be on a lot of listeners' minds? Money, what people get paid, compensation, especially when it's unequal or people have suspicion or anxiety or resentment about it. And then issues like everything from who gets to take time off and who doesn't, paid leave, parental leave. You have sections on that. Can you touch on some of those, how these principles fit there?
Yeah, I mean, I'll return to your idea that this really is a great book for people who are in leadership or people who are wanting to move into leadership to help inform their values and their opportunities when they get into those roles. And, you know, some of the interest I've been getting from people is faith communities around the country who are really interested in this. In the not-for-profit spaces, schools and higher ed, healthcare, places where we know that human dignity and human effort, it almost can't be legislated. I mean, you can't look over people's shoulder every minute to make sure they're doing their best by a patient or by a kid in a classroom. So we've got to rely on people to be at their best, and we need to create the systems and structures that support them to be at their best. And that includes, yeah, like trusting that they're being as compensated as fairly as they possibly can in their industry, that every effort is being made to make sure that they get what they need when they're ill or when their kid is born or whatever. That goes into transparency around communication, which I also talk a lot about in the book. Transparency when you get asked a question, especially in a leadership role, and you say, I actually don't know that, and I'm thanking you for asking me this question. That's not like being called out or embarrassed. It's just saying the truth. So for me, transparency helps sometimes is one of those important things that we need to practice as we get on the way to finding the answers that work for everybody.
I know listeners think that what Kit just said makes this book a work of fiction. It's not. I mean, it doesn't have to be. And as we get ready to wrap here, I wanted to spend more time on the subject of listening at work, because I know that a lot of people everywhere, I mean, everybody probably can think of a time where you really didn't feel heard, or you didn't feel respected. And you write that passion can make for poor listening. And if there's an epidemic of poor listening in the workplace, Aaron, do you feel like when someone at Gandhi needs to talk, that you know how to tone down either your passions, your fire, or your own opinions and ideas, and create space just to take and to receive?
So one of the benefits of working at the Institute, and I've been there for 10 years or so, is that we practice this stuff. Like it's part of our shared agreements that we have. And so, you know, we're all works in progress, but generally speaking, I'm able to catch myself, and I've got colleagues that are good for letting it be known when I don't. And that's an important aspect of our culture at the Institute also.
About 30 seconds. How do you catch yourself when you realize you're engaging in the kind of behavior that is not a good example of listening?
I'll hear myself literally, and or also reading the room and seeing the response of the person who I'm in conversation with. You know, if I feel a flash of anger, it's become my norm to kind of check in with myself after that. So
you're looking for evidence at times that you may be not modeling what you want to model.
100%.
Again, this is not a work of fiction. It's a really great book. Where do people find Culture Shift Nonviolence at Work, Kit?
A couple of the local bookstores carry it. Akimbo Books carries it, as does Hippocampo, and then bookshop.org. And then other large global organizations are also selling it.
Who probably don't even need to be named.
Exactly.
There you go. Kit Miller, thank you for sharing this with us. And thank you for sharing your time and your expertise.
Same.
Wonderful to have you. Aaron Thompson, thank you for making the time.
I appreciate this. Thank you, Evan.
You both really always fill up our cups here. From all of us at Connections, thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on member-supported Public Radio.